This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are your clothes safe? Alina Bartel, owner of the Natural Clothing Company, advises us on fabrics, chemicals, and organic clothes. Dr. Joe Alton, MD, about learning emergency medicine when help doesn't come. Woody Tash helps develop local food with slow money. It's Radio EcoShock. Hi there, I'm Alex Smith. We're back with more local solutions for global problems from the Mother Earth News Fair. This time I picked three of the most intriguing interviews. Each seemed at first like a small problem, and then each guest, all feature speakers at the fair, takes us much deeper into the industrial and financial mess and out again with practical things we can do. Alina Bartel surprised me. I mean, do we really need organic clothes? Our discussion went from the poison fields of Asia and Central America through the industrial fashion machine that feeds the store shelves. We talk a little bit about whether you can trust a government. The earth and the workers are damaged at every step of that process. But many Americans suffer from such allergies and skin reactions to the chemicals used in clothing manufacture. There is a residue of pesticides. I'm sure you know that. Let's talk with Alina from the Radio EcoShock Mobile Studio at the Mother Earth News Fair in Puyallup, Washington.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a bit of an embarrassing question for you. Are the clothes you're wearing right now safe? And what about that cheap stuff you got for the kids at the big box store? It's the kind of thing we almost don't want to talk about, but these are products from a super industrial society that we put right next to our skin for hours at a time. Here to talk to us about that is Alina Bartel. She's the owner of the Natural Clothing Company. They retail eco-friendly and organic clothing. And they're based in Snohomish County in Washington. Is that correct?
That's right.
USA? Good. Well, welcome to Radio EcoShock, Alina.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a bit of a tough question. I mean, in a way, some people don't want to hear about this. They're, you know, it's a little close to home to think that maybe the clothes you're wearing are not safe for you. Can you talk to us about that?
Oh, absolutely. It is a difficult question because our environment, period, is not that safe. So when people point out, oh, you should be worried about this, should be worried about that, you know, it becomes overwhelming. I don't tell people to change their whole wardrobe. But if we all become more and more aware that maybe there are better choices when you shop for the next clothing item, just give it a chance. Take a look at the organic, compare, you know, and then slowly, slowly, gradually, maybe we can be making more and more difference. You know, that's how I look at that.
Well, for some people, the idea that there can be organic clothes is a new idea. I mean, what is organic clothing?
That's a very good question. The standards for organic textiles basically are addressed towards mostly organic crops. And it's basically the same thing as you eat, you know, organic corn vs. conventional, probably GMO modified corn. So the biggest crop that the textile comes from, it's cotton. And many people don't realize that cotton is actually chemically sprayed way more than any other crop that goes towards human consumption, probably because of that. Because it doesn't go directly to human consumption. So the statistics show it's about 2.5 or 3% as far as acreage coverage, cotton of all the crops, but it's sprayed 24 to 25% of world chemicals, especially insecticides, goes for cotton. So if you do the math, it's about 10 times than you would logically think the regular proportions are. So it's sprayed very heavily. Cotton is very sensitive to insects. But the insecticides and pesticides work on insects just kind of like a Agent Orange. They paralyze insects' nerve system and the bug falls off and dies. Now, there are studies that show these chemicals actually bind with plant. But even if they don't, they go in our soil. You know, they get washed with the water, they go in the air, they go in lungs of people that work with that. Eventually they go, you know, with the water, they go in.
I've read about cotton fields in Russia where so much insecticides were used that now the land is pretty well sterile, that you can't, it's poison.
Absolutely.
And I think that's happening in many places of the world. Absolutely. And we don't ask those questions when we buy the clothes.
No, we don't ask that question. It's waking up more and more, but we don't ask too many questions. I'm originally from Poland, and it's kind of funny. I grew up in a communist system. And by the time you were going to school and become a teenager, you started asking more and more questions, and you realized that pretty much everything what is being told to you was a lie. Because all the media, radio and TV, was owned by the government, so you knew the guy comes and says something, and you looked at him and you knew it's pretty much a lie. I'm finding myself living in the United States now for 30 years, and I see a lot of media putting out information and recognizing it's a lie, but a lot of other people don't, you know? It's almost funny. So it's good to look into that, you know? It's just good to look into that. We are poisoning our environment. And when you think of agriculture, it almost in the background of your mind, you think of this plane flying by and spraying all this stuff. Where does it go? You know, it goes in the plants, in the soil, in the air, in the water. It doesn't disappear. It doesn't disappear. It goes, yeah, when it goes in the soil, it sterilizes everything.
Now, what about garment workers? Because we've just seen a terrible disaster in Bangladesh where a building collapsed, many garment workers were killed. But I have to wonder about the health of garment workers if they're handling toxic cotton products, if it's still laced with these pesticides and herbicides when they get it.
Absolutely. Most of the, at least two-thirds of the chemicals in insecticides and pesticides are carcinogenic, and the incidence of diseases between cotton workers is much higher than the regular population. It absolutely is. There is a study in Iowa that the children that were exposed to the pesticides versus control population was, or their age group was like twice as high with different diseases. There's all these things, you know, that we wonder why there's more autism, why there's more that. It's very actually hard to put the exact link. This particular toxins cause this. So government doesn't have proof. But we know that we are poisoning our environment, and one way or another, we are weakening the immune system. I came to the interest in organic clothing because my 11-year-old got suddenly very, very ill, and we went through years of climbing all kinds of different medications, working with 20 different doctors, trying to figure out what the heck, where does it come from, how are we going to cure it. Many other kids responded to medication, but he didn't. So day and night, me and my husband, we were doing research of what else can we do? What else can we do, you know? Holistic medicine, conventional medicine, and everything else, and my understanding out of that. Now, that's my own experience. I'm not claiming anything that works or doesn't work. It worked for me. We left town, we got our 5 acres, we got our chicken and goats, and I grew my own food, so I would know what I'm feeding my kid. And he's graduating from high school now, and he's doing fine. He still has health issues, but he can function, he's doing well, he's healthy, you know, within the limits of that.
You're not the first mother to tell me this story. You know, I've talked to another natural food specialist who started out because she had 2 sick kids and just had to work out all the different possibilities. She also moved to the country. She also started totally working out through the diet and making sure. And her kids are better, not totally better, but doing better. So I think we're hearing this story fairly often. Getting back to the clothing part, the other thing I've always wondered about, sorry, Alina Bartel, is sometimes you get these clothes, boy, they never need to be ironed. They seem to dry in 2 seconds. There's some sort of special treatment that those clothes are getting at the clothing plant. Is there, or am I just being paranoid about?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. My business originally started online. Now I have the actual physical store. But 30 to 40% of my clients from online are people that cannot wear anything else. They have literally sometimes few shirts only because they have to be organic. They have to be non-dyed. Their system doesn't tolerate anything else. And what happens is when the fiber goes through manufacturing process, you know, there is sizing put into the fiber so it's strong enough to go through the machines. And then originally it was starch. And with time, as our chemistry improves, there is more and more chemicals added to that. It allows to take a lower grade fiber, like cotton, for example, which comes in many different grades, and make it behave and look and feel like a higher grade. And then when the textile is, you know, it's a many-step process. When the textile is actually finished, the same process occurs. When they spray it with different solutions, you know, of many different components, it will look nicer and smoother. And you probably observe sometimes you buy something and it looks so beautiful and smooth. And then after the wash, it's just not the same garment. There is a difference. Something was put on top of that. And in my personal opinion, that's probably more toxic than the actual dyes. Dyes are a problem too, but that's actually the biggest problem, the finishing that comes on most of the conventional clothing. And people know now not to just put it on your skin to wash it, you know, but how much of that actually will get to your system and how much not.
Has anybody taken a piece of clothing and just taken it to the lab and looked at it and said, yes, we find these pesticides, or yes, we find these chemicals in it? Has this science been done, do you know?
There are tests, but now as you think of who is interested in that and who is interested in not allowing and undermining studies like that, you know, the difference of money basically that goes on both sides, it isn't the exact science. Just like you cannot really take an apple, an organic apple, and go through the test, and unless you know the history how that apple was grown, you know, you cannot really test that this apple is organic or not organic, or it isn't easy, at least for, to my knowledge. It's similar with the textile. You have to monitor the history of it, how it was produced, and how, and know. Basically, the advantage is that you know what is not on that product. Everything that I sell does not have chemicals on it. You were talking about wrinkle resistant, talking about babies wearing things that are flame-proof and, you know, retardant. It's insane. There is formaldehyde in it. There is poisons put on a baby's clothing. And children, why I started this business, their weight is so much smaller than ours. So basically what our body, we might get a rash, we might tolerate it somehow, not greatly. For the baby, it's like they would get 20 times the amount of that because of the body weight difference. And their skin is much thinner than ours, so it's more permeable. And of course, skin is our largest organ. It actually absorbs everything without going through intestines. If you just use logic without even, you know, science telling this or that, it doesn't make sense. Humanity was wearing some kind of covering for tens of thousands, probably millions of years. You know, the oldest clothes is like 34,000 years ago. So we were wearing this for 34,000 years at least. And we are wearing that chemicals on our clothing for the last 60 years. It doesn't make sense.
You're really making me concerned when you talk about the babies. I understand what you're saying about body weight and sensitivity. That sounds so important. And you mentioned flame retardants. I believe it's the law that you have to spray that stuff on baby clothes, isn't it?
Right. When I sell clothes that, which I get requests all the time for, you know, for sleeping, they are not called pajamas, they are called long johns or something else. Because if they were pajamas, they would have to come under these different specifications, and I don't even want to look into it.
Isn't it wild? Because I know people who would not have flame retardants on their couch if they knew about it, or in their carpets, but don't ask about their baby clothes.
Right. I think that's a really difficult question. You know, I have a store and I deal with customers every day, and there's a lot of people coming, buying gifts, buying, you know, buying things for kids. And I think the problem is we can only handle so much danger coming to us. If I tell them too much, their eyes will glaze over and they go, it's too much. I cannot worry about absolutely everything. So I just give them a little bit information to consider. And I read somewhere, and I think it's true, that the actual change, like changing clothing, it's a big subject. It's a huge industry. It's billions of dollars and millions of people working in it. It will take a generation to change. So I invite people to just look at that a little bit in whatever step it's comfortable for them. If it's moving to natural fibers instead of nylon and polyester, that's already a step in a good direction. And that's something people can confront and say, yeah, you know, maybe I can do. And then instead of using regular cotton, maybe looking next item, how much would it be to buy organic? It's a tiny industry. It's a very small organic section. It's like less than 1% of all the cotton garments. But if we start looking at these little steps, you know, it will be growing.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that there's a part of the clothing industry that's moving towards wood products. And it's even coming from some of the ancient boreal forest growth in northern Canada. It's rayon.
Right.
And it's made from wood pulp. And these big forests are being cut down for people to wear. Have you looked into rayon at all? Do you have any opinion about it?
I do have opinions on everything. If we want to be closed, period. I mean, if we want to wear clothes, and Mark Twain said the person that doesn't wear clothes doesn't get much respect in our society.
They get arrested, actually.
You know, you start to have to be making some compromise, you know? You, even if you wear just leather and wool, you have to start making compromise. It has to be manufactured. There's no way of clothing us and living in a society and being absolutely, like, innocent. A lot of people ask me, so what is the best fiber? What is the best solution? You know, each of us has to make personal choices. I think natural fibers, the word textile actually comes from the word weave in Latin. The woven fibers are out of, you know, like cotton, like hemp, like wool. They preserve the most, the actual fiber. The rayon, the problem with rayon is it is chemically changed. It's basically fused in a way together. It's not a weave that makes it. The material is, you know, via some chemicals, it is altered. But it's still, in some way, I would prefer, personally, maybe made it out of wood, but sustainable wood, you know, just like we still use paper, but it can come from recycled sources or sustainably harvested wood. Then, like nylon and polyester, comes straight from crude oil, which cannot be renewed easily, cannot be helped by us. And obviously, you know, there's lots of problem with getting more and more oil. I used to think it comes from byproducts of oil industry. No, it comes straight from crude. So we go and we drill in places where we shouldn't be. We spill. We go to wars, you know, to get oil, to wear nylon and polyester or other things. So even to answer your question, even with rayon, there is a bit difference where it comes from. What is the original?
Yes, the legal term is chain of custody, and I think that's what we need to look out for as consumers. As you say, is where did it come from? A lot of people don't know about nylon production, that it also releases a lot of global warming gases.
Oh, absolutely.
It can change the climate. If we all wore a lot of nylon, it's not good for us in that sense, too.
Right.
Well, as we wrap up, what are the resources for people who are concerned about their clothing? Where can they look? What can they do?
You know, they can ask for organic clothing. It's interesting. Just coming, I'll be speaking at the fair today at the end of the day also. Just kind of looking through data. I'm also writing a book about organic clothing because there isn't much information about it. And when I realized that, I decided to put it out. When the organic clothing, the term became popular maybe 10 years ago, maybe earlier than that, but it became more popular. And when I looked at the graph, like on the internet, how many searches for organic clothing, like the peak time was maybe around 2007, 2008. So if we would assign number 100, like Google does for it, for that number in 2008, right now it's about 2025. If everybody just digests that one fact, so there's one quarter of an interest that was a few years ago in organic clothing. That's where we have to turn it around. There is fewer companies. There is fewer manufacturers. There is a lot of PR about how H&M, which is a big chain, or some big designers are going in organic clothing. They are doing it just for the money. They are doing it just for the glory of saying this is organic or this is hemp. They are, you know, designer items. It's not anything that our homesteaders will wear. The actual demand for organic clothing has been shrinking. So we have to turn it around. We have to ask where people can go to the store and say, what do you have in organic cotton?
Yes. Well, I think I wonder if the timing of that was partly due to the economic downturn.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the biggest, I'm sure, factor. And I totally understand. We watch our wallet very, very closely. I absolutely understand. But, you know, I saw my T-shirts for $24 and $26. Yes, you can buy a cheaper T-shirt. But no, if you need a good T-shirt, it's not the amount that will break you. It's just a question of interest and understanding and going like, okay, my next garment, if I need to buy it, if I don't need to buy it, don't buy it or buy it from the thrift store. But if I want to buy a new item, I will look for organic.
Well, people have a lot of clothing, and some people, frankly, have way too much clothing.
Yeah,
you know, they're getting storage lockers to put all the stuff they bought. So I think perhaps we should be looking at having less clothing so we have less impact on the world. But the stuff we have is really good and really safe and didn't hurt the world to get it. If we have that process, then we'll come out on top.
Absolutely, I totally agree. I do have a very active website, and on a front page on the bottom it says, I really don't think you need much more, but if you do, buy organic.
What is your website, please?
It's naturalclothingcompany.com.
Naturalclothingcompany.com. Alina Bartel, it's been a pleasure talking with you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We're back with more Radio EcoShock. At first, I thought Dr. Joe Alton and his wife, Nurse Amy, were kind of fringe characters. Having met Joe and listened to his story, I've changed my mind. Here we go.
This is Alex Smith. We're at the Mother Earth News Fair with yet another really interesting interview coming up, I think, with Dr. Joe Alton. Dr. Joe has some ideas about how we could all be prepared to look after each other if we run into an emergency. If you think that's far-fetched, I don't think so. Just think about Katrina. There was no medical help for 3 days. Whatever was there was what was there, so maybe it's best we all learn more about how to look after our bodies. So Dr. Joe Alton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Alex.
So you do your own radio program, you do books under the label of Doom and Bloom. Why do you call it that?
Well, originally, it's funny, we started because we're master gardeners for the state of Florida, and we were originally going to do a gardening site. And so it was going to be survival and medicinal gardening. And then we found out that so many people were interested in getting medical education and finding out what they could do in the event of a disaster, let's say, or if they lived in a remote setting where help was not immediately on the way. They really wanted some of this medical information. And for us, it was sort of having to think out of the box because there's a sort of secrecy in the medical establishment. They really don't want a lot of people to, of the regular people, to know about the things that we do, how to, let's say, suture a wound, when you should close a wound, when you should leave a wound open, things like that. And we found that the demand for that kind of knowledge was so great that we decided to go out on a limb and try to make people better medical assets than they are now. We don't hand them medical diplomas, and we don't tell them to, if they need a brain transplant, and there's a hospital with a brain surgeon nearby, we want them to not try to do it themselves, But we do want them to be better resources for their family in times of trouble or in remote settings than they are now.
And you don't just call yourself a doctor. You're a real doctor. Would you tell us about your qualifications?
I'm a medical doctor, MD, and I'm a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and the American College of OBGYN. When I was young, I delivered a lot of babies, and as you get older, you sort of morph into a pelvic surgeon, so to speak. So everything below the belly button, I can take you apart and put you back together.
And you work with your wife, Amy. Tell us about Amy.
My lovely wife, Amy, is an advanced registered nurse practitioner, and she was a certified nurse midwife as well. So she also delivered a lot of babies and worked in local university hospitals and taught at local nursing schools.
Now, what sets you apart from some doctors is that you apparently believe that we could run into a serious breakdown in society, and you're not alone in that. A lot of my listeners also believe that. So tell us about that.
Well, you know that there are many different disasters that could befall us. Just this week, we saw a tragedy of people dying in tornadoes. Two women died in floods in San Antonio, Texas. I mean, there's always the chance of natural disasters that could befall us in this area of Washington. I believe you're on some earthquake faults, and there's a risk of flooding sometimes. So I think that it's really important to understand that even if a particular disaster has a very, very small chance of occurring, that there's so many different types of things that can happen, both natural and man-made types of disasters, that what is the chance that none of these things is going to happen to you or maybe your children in your lifetime or their lifetimes. And so it only makes sense to be medically prepared for issues that may occur as a result of either not being where help isn't immediately available or in the aftermath of a disaster where help is there but overwhelmed.
Now, I went last night and looked at one of your YouTube videos, and this one was on heat stress and heat strokes. And you have a little bit of fun during the video, too. And I like that. You know, you're not just making it all serious and heavy. There was a lot of fun going on there. But you did pass on some really useful information. And I think some of our listeners are interested because we've had severe heat occurrences in the last couple of years, like in Texas, where it just went to 35 and stayed there every day for over a month and didn't cool down much at night. We had an incident in France where an estimated 30,000 people died because of the heat, which they were not prepared for. So what were some of the things that you discussed in that video that would help people?
Well, I think the important thing is, first, you must get the person that has been exposed to the heat or maybe in heat stroke away from the heat source. It's very simple. Most of this stuff is very, very common sense. There are times when your environment is your friend, and there are times when your environment is your enemy. And if you have someone who is suffering from heat-related illness, get them out of the sun as soon as possible. These types of people, if they're wearing clothes, you should take their clothes off. You should apply moist, if you can't drench these people in cold and cool water, then you want to at least apply moist compresses in areas where blood vessels run close to the skin to effectively deliver cool temperatures to the body core. Those areas would be your neck, would be your groin area, and would be your armpit or axillary area. These are things that are important to do. You would fan somebody if you had electricity. You use a fan to help evaporate the heat. And also, if you don't have a fan, just fan the person with a piece of cardboard if that's all you have. The one thing that's very important, though, that is very important, is that you want to elevate the feet of the person about maybe 12 inches. So, in other words, put them in the shock position so that you can make sure there's good blood flow to the brain. And you want to avoid giving fluids to this person unless you're certain that they're alert, because otherwise, many times, fluids will go down the wrong tube. So instead of going down the esophagus, it may go down an airway. And if that happens, you might be in worse shape than you were when you started.
So they may be mumbling, but if they're not coherent, you're not giving them water.
I'm not giving them fluids.
Okay. Now, the other thing that you mentioned in that video that interested me is there are certain temperatures at which the person is no longer sweaty. They don't look hot necessarily. They may be dry looking. Now,
you're absolutely right. You know, at about 106 degrees of Fahrenheit, which I think would be 30. To tell, you'll have to let me know.
I'm not sure either. We'll go with the Fahrenheit.
Okay, we'll go with the Fahrenheit then. Sounds good. My apologies to our friends in Europe and Australia. But once you hit 106 degrees Fahrenheit, your body loses the ability to use sweating as a mechanism to eliminate excess heat from the body. And so once that happens, the skin is hot, but it's dry. If you actually go into shock, your skin could become cold and clammy, actually, but a body core temperature will reveal the truth that you are over, say, 106 degrees. And sometimes people go all the way up to 110 and do survive it, 110 degrees Fahrenheit, but sometimes they don't.
So it is possible to die of heat stroke.
Yes, indeed.
Well, some of our listeners believe climate change is coming, and if the electricity goes out, you've got no air conditioning. You're going to have to figure out a way to cool off. So that's one thing that you cover, but you cover a lot more than that, and you provide the materials and also the lists for people to be prepared for an emergency. Do you want to talk about your medical packs and also whether people can just use the lists without buying the medical pack?
Yeah, actually, the funny thing about our mission is that I could care less if I sell any of our medical kits. Even though we have an entire line of medical kits that go from a 1 pound, 1.5 pound hiker, biker kit, that type of thing, to all the way to a large, full backpack filled with the ability to deal with multiple episodes of traumatic injury, we freely publish all the contents of every single pack that we have. And the reasons why we put things in those individual packs, because we want people to have the items that are in those packs. We don't care whether they have a pack that comes from our design, let's say. We just want them to have lots of medical supplies so that we freely publish those. We want people to take a look at that and see how it would make sense for them. And we want them to work with it in such a fashion so that the way they pack it makes sense for them. I mean, can you reach things that you need for a particular injury easily? And can you accustom yourself to putting together a pack that is organized for you and that you can act quickly with? That's the most important thing, to be able to act quickly.
Well, people stock up on food. They may stock up on self-defense, but they probably don't have enough bandages or any of those things, and they feel that they don't need to. They'll dial 911.
Well, I think that is pretty short-sighted. And, you know, I know a lot of people are all about the beans and the bullets, but we are all about the bandages. And one thing I'd like to just relate to people, and this is really, really important, that you could never, ever have too many medical supplies. No matter how many people that you think that you're going to be responsible for in times of trouble or in a homestead community, there's always going to be more people that are going to knock on your door and may ask you for medical help, especially if they're aware that you have medical skills and that you have put together supplies. So always have more than you think you need. Remember that in any time of trouble, that excess medical supplies will be extraordinarily valuable barter items.
You know, I'm looking at this. I don't have any medical skills to speak of. I might be able to do CPR in an emergency. That's about it. So I've got a lot to learn. You must have figured out what the average person could learn. Is that what you put in your book? And if so, tell us about that.
Yes, you're absolutely. Not only do I write everything in plain English, and I essentially tell people strategies that I believe are relatively easy to remember, that can be step by step, and give them some clear indications of how they can identify some of the most common things that you would encounter in a remote setting or in a situation where you can't depend maybe on, you know, sterilized water or clean food or properly prepared food. But we also do it in such a fashion that people can feel comfortable that they can be the medically responsible person. It's all in plain English. It's all there. And the supplies that we talk about, how to use the supplies. And this is something that people really don't think that they have the potential to learn how to take care of other people, be medically responsible for themselves and for other people. But this is something that's very, very basic. And most of the issues that you can deal with medically in a disaster situation are things that are well within the non-medical professional's grasp. There are situations that are not going to be within the thoracic or trauma surgeon's grasp in some situations where the grid is down. You know, some chest wounds, things like that, are just not going to be survivable, or brain injuries are not going to be survivable, even with the best of skills. And we have to understand that, and I'm very realistic about that in the book as well. So I'm not suggesting to people that they're going to have miracle cures of major traumatic injuries, but I will want to give them the best chance of getting their patients to recover from survivable injuries.
Why aren't we taught these things in school? How did we come into a culture where we're so separated from looking after our own bodies?
Because we are in a culture in which we're not responsible for most of the services that we receive. We're not responsible for doing just about anything for ourselves anymore. And so as a result, when modern technology is available to us, you know, it's very easy for us to allow a small number of people to be in charge of that technology. And when they're in charge of that, a small number of people are in charge of these things, then other people feel that, well, we are actually in good hands. And you are. I mean, most of the people that take care of us, you know, medically or have the best of intentions. I'm not saying that they don't, but I believe that it's just very important to take some responsibility yourself as well.
Yeah, I think as a parent, that would be one thing. And a lot of parents do. They try and get some little handbook that they can have on the shelf at least and recognize if this child is in serious need of help or not. It's something we should do as parents. Do you feel that you have been put in a fringe category because you're coming out and speaking out on this?
I have had some criticism from the medical establishment for what we're doing, but I really consider this to be a mission. And this mission is to allow people to have a chance to protect their family medically in situations where we cannot depend on medical help to be, or modern medical help to be readily available. And there are many circumstances where that is the case and we just don't realize it. As far as I'm concerned, I will say that I've actually had as many physicians support, you know, my views as I've had physicians criticize my views. As a matter of fact, many physicians are people that buy our medical kits. So I'm actually gratified to hear that from some. But from my standpoint, I really don't care if there is criticism. I really feel that it's important, very important, for people to become better medical resources for their families, for their loved ones in the event of disasters or in remote settings, because if you don't do it, then no one else will.
So please, Joe Alton, tell us the name of your book and your website so people can follow up.
The name of the book is The Survival Medicine Handbook, When Help Is Not on the Way. And we are at www.doomandbloom.net, and you'll find over 300 articles on medical preparedness absolutely free on the website.
I'm going to try and educate myself. Thank you so much for being on Radio EcoShock.
You're so welcome.
Woody Tash is a man who worked the finance industry and then reevaluated his life. He longed to find a way to stimulate the growth of local food sheds with local finance. That developed into his book, Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. Here's my chat with Woody at the Mother Earth News Fair last June.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest here at the Mother Earth News Fair is Woody Tash. We're going to talk about slow money. Now, I don't very often have anybody who knows anything about venture capitalism on this show. We're going to talk about slow money, and the thing is that eventually we all might need some help, some investment, and we don't know where it's going to come from, and Woody's going to tell us a little bit about that. So would you introduce yourself just a little bit? Let people know who you are.
Sure. Well, you got my name right. It's Woody Tash. About 6 years ago, I took a year off from what I was then doing, which was running a national investor network that was steering money to sustainable businesses. And I took a year off to collect my thoughts, I guess you'd say. And I did, and it came out as a book on slow money. And then for the last 4+ years, I've been trying to catch up with the idea. So, meaning we now have about 20 chapters in the U.S., one in France, about to have one in Australia. And these are just groups of people who are getting together with their friends and neighbors and starting to make small investments in food businesses near where they live, supporting organic food businesses and local food systems, which is really, pretty simple on one level. But in today's world, I guess it's not completely simple. And it's definitely different from venture capital. That's why I made the little crack about venture capital, which I'm not against per se. I'm just against thinking that's all there is. And this is another way to do investing in small private businesses.
All right. Well, that went by a little quickly for me because I think there's various stages to it. So let's deconstruct it a little bit here. So where does it start in this chain of things that you're talking about?
Basically, you didn't say what is slow money. So good that we don't have to start there, but we can go there if we need to. But if I just say things like, if we just talk about the money part of this, we're giving our money to people we don't know very well to invest in things that they don't fully understand halfway around the world in places most of us will never visit. Then you pause on that for a second and say, does that seem like a recipe for building a better future? And of course it doesn't when you say it like that. And that is not, to me, not too much of an oversimplification of what our financial markets have turned into. They're just gross abstractions with money zooming around seeking so-called risk-adjusted rates of return and who knows what, with derivatives being the most egregious abstraction. But that's only an extreme example of something that goes through the whole system. So we've got this very abstract financial system and all of our investment capital. If you have it in a bank or you have it somewhere, it's at least in part supporting that system, usually mostly supporting that system. So that's part of the it. That's the money part. And then the other part is the food part, which is what those of us in slow money feel is that a very concrete, specific thing we can do to take some of our money out of that crazy abstraction is to put it to work in something we understand near where we live. And there's nothing much more tangible than food. And so, it's not super high tech. It's not super complicated. These are small businesses that make our communities better. They're just not very profitable, which is the slow part, meaning we're not doing it to make a lot of money. We're doing it because we want to take some of our money away from something we don't believe in and put it into something we do believe in.
Okay. Could you maybe give us an example of one of the early projects that you helped support?
Oh, sure. So investing has been going on for a little over 3 years under this loose banner of slow money. And we're over $30 million now into over 220 small food businesses around the country, one in Europe, one in Switzerland. So this is everything from a couple of $1,000 loan to a farmer who needs a new piece of something or wants to buy a few chicks or whatever, but a small capital investment of some kind, all the way up to a few $1 million. And the largest investment was one person, actually just recently, a couple of weeks ago, invested $3 million in a milk cooperative in Maine from one investor. That was very unusual, obviously. The vast majority of them are small loans that two or three or four people team up on and maybe lend, let's say, $14,000 is one that jumps out and sticks in my head for some reason to buy a cold storage truck for a delivery business in North Carolina. And for four people teamed up and lent $14,000 between the four of them. So it's a lot of small things, and it's in all areas of the food system. It's everything from the individual producer all the way through. It can be processing, distribution, grain mills, creameries, slaughterhouses, restaurants that source locally. And if people are interested in hearing this and want to see examples, they can either go on the slowmoney.org website and see a bunch of examples there, or they can go to Slow Money Maine or Slow Money North Carolina. That's slowmoneync.org. And Slow Money North Carolina, Carol from that chapter is here speaking at the same event. She just published a book called Financing Our Food Shed. And she has personally, in the last 3 years, facilitated, I think she's up to 39 peer-to-peer loans in North Carolina to small food businesses totaling over $700,000. All of those loans are listed on the Slow Money North Carolina website, all of the entrepreneurs, what the business is, how much money they got. So it's a little of everything is the answer to your question. It's pretty much any small enterprise that's involved in food production, processing, distribution, or retailing.
I find this exciting.
It is exciting. It's actually it's at moments very inspiring. We just had our fourth national gathering in Boulder, Colorado a month ago. We had 650 people from 37 states and 5 or 6 countries there. But the inspiring part, well, that was partially inspiring, was how many people came and who they were. But we had 25 small food businesses presenting that we picked from all over the country. And when you see those 25 entrepreneurs all present for 5 minutes, one right after the other on stage, it is extremely inspiring. I mean, it gives you hope that against all the odds, some good stuff could happen.
How do the four people in North Carolina, for example, find the person who has this need for the refrigeration truck to keep going? How does that happen?
We have this magician named Carol Pepe Hewitt who's matchmaking. In that case, that's one of the interesting things about slow money, especially if anyone listening knows anything about finance, you know that it tends to get pigeonholed into very narrow boxes. It's a this, it's a that, it's an equity thing. This is very diverse. I mean, so we have 20 some odd chapters and they're all doing things a little differently. And Carol in North Carolina is the one who's doing this peer-to-peer kind of magic show where she's actually matchmaking people who have money, people who need money. Doesn't work all the time, but she's spending most of her time just networking around the state of North Carolina. Now people know she's starting to get a little reputation, and people who have some money to put into the food system are starting to know she's there, and the entrepreneurs are starting to know she's there. I mean, I was going to say there's no magic. There is magic to it, but it's not a science. I mean, she is really just putting herself out there. Under the banner of slow money, we have something called the slow money principles, which is just it's a one-page set of ideas. The first one says we must bring our money back down to earth. I mean, it's very basic. But we have a vision that unites us. And other than that vision, as far as the deals go, it's everybody just finding each other and figuring out how they can help one another. So there's not like a simple answer to your question, but I'm proud to say she is doing it. The other chapters are operating a little differently. They have public meetings. They, you know, put on an event somewhere, 100 people show up, and they have a few entrepreneurs will come up on the stage and present some things to the people who are there. Sometimes they do it on a farm field. It might be a little bigger, like Northern California has done a few big ones where they have a big tent and 250 people show up on a farm. So it's a series of activities that are not uniform, but that are all doing the same thing, which is just connecting people and letting people, you know, find one another.
Well, supposing I'm going to retire and I've got some money, I've got a little bit of money, and I want to put in $25,000. I believe in what you're saying. I want to cooperate with that. Am I going to get a return on my money?
Excellent question. I can't guarantee that you will. You might. I mean, we're making investments, so like any investment, you have to kind of figure out how risky you think it is compared to something else you might do with those same dollars. So the first thing I would say, you didn't ask it this way, but I'd say the first thing any financial person would tell you is get diversification. So if you have $25,000, if you're only going to put it in one thing and hope it works, that's probably not a great strategy. That's a basic, that's not special to slow money. That's any kind of financial dealing. So let's say give me a little more advice. I might say, if you live near a slow money chapter, that would be good. Then you can start going to the chapter meetings, meeting the entrepreneurs, meeting your other investors, getting an idea of what's out there. And then maybe patiently put that money to work over a couple of years in at least several different things, not all in one thing. So that's part of the answer. The most of the transactions are low interest loans. So if you said, how do these things work? Most of them, there's no one size fits all. We don't legislate it. It's up to people involved to figure it out. But most of them are loans of, let's say, 3%, 4%, 5%, often without collateral. So like these are things like no banker would ever do it like this. Sometimes the slow money chapters reduce the interest rate from what the entrepreneur asked for. In other words, we're doing this to help the entrepreneurs. That's the main reason we're doing these things. So the question of, you know, can you be assured of getting all your money back plus the interest rate? You cannot be assured. There is no such thing as a free lunch or a sure investment, I guess. But I think we all believe if we do enough of this over a long enough period of time, we'll be happy with the performance and the combination of the financial returns and the benefits to the community that we're generating.
I'm reaching for the name of the small loan system that was developed in Bangladesh and spread throughout the developing world, where very small loans were made to, say, a woman who wanted to get a goat, etc. Does that have a relationship to what you're doing?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's Grameen Bank you're referring to, and it's a very high-profile example because it spawned the whole industry that's called microfinance now. And the basic idea there was a relationships between a group of people who live in a village, the reciprocity in those relationships was strong enough to actually reduce the risk of making small loans, even though bankers would never have done it. And Muhammad Yunus, the guy who did it, the economist who did it, actually, I think the first one was $47. It was some funny number like that, where he actually just took the money out of his pocket and made the loan, and it got paid back. And then he realized, wow, you know, there's something here. So it's a very large number of really small loans. And I don't know what their averages are now. I don't track it currently, but I'd be surprised if their average loan was more than $500. I mean, I think it's a lot of very small loans. And there are websites now like kiva.org, K-I-V-A.org, where individuals can go on. You can pick a small, like a micro entrepreneur in a developing country and lend them through Kiva $50, which they will batch together into, say, a $500 loan to give to the entrepreneur. So you're right to bring that up. What we're doing is, let's say, you could say is a kind of a U.S. analog or something, but it's larger because we're talking about businesses. We're not talking about like a cell phone entrepreneur in a village in a developing country. We're talking about someone who's got a diversified organic farm or a CSA or a processing business. Oftentimes, well, usually they need at least tens of thousands. Sometimes they need hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. So it's definitely in another place in the financial continuum. But in the U.S., I don't think anyone knows the answer to this question. Is a $10,000 loan to a farmer a microloan in the U.S.? Almost. I mean, in the U.S. economy, that's almost like a microloan. Certainly a $5,000 loan might be called a microloan. My hope is that we're going to show that the shared vision and local knowledge of investors will actually have a similarly salutary effect on the outcome from an arithmetic standpoint. But it's going to take us a while to show that. I mean, we're only 3 years into this, and I do think what we're doing is riskier than a $50 or $100 loan to one person in a village, because it's a more complicated business. You know, as I said, you know, getting, let's say, growing a CSA, let's say, just take that as an example, community supported agriculture. It's a pretty complicated undertaking. You might have hundreds of customers, and it's a several hundred thousand dollar a year business no matter what. It's just more complicated than a super, you know, just a, you know, so-called micro enterprise. So, but 10 years from now, we'll have all the data. Right now, we're all taking the risk. Those of us who are doing it are creating the data for everybody else to look at. You could call it a big pioneering demonstration project. But so thank you for bringing that up, because the Bangladesh experience was, let's say, the first part of the thread, and now we're kind of following it back to another place.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're at the Mother Earth News Fair. Our guest is Woody Tash. We're talking about slow money. Well, Woody, you have set up a nonprofit. Tell us what you personally do.
We're just kind of, blowing on the embers or spreading the seeds, whatever metaphor you want to use. I mean, we've got, I would say the main thing I've learned over the last 4 years is that there are, I believe, at least a few million Americans who want something like this to happen. And the first part of it is that there's just a need for an authentic, nuanced conversation about what's broken in food and finance. And a lot of times people who are so-called foodies or people who are in the food movement, they don't talk about finance that often, but as soon as you start having the discussion, it's like, oh my God, of course. Because, you know, industrial agriculture is just the other side of the coin from industrial finance. I mean, it's the same. There's many ways to talk about it. You know, you can talk about, maybe the simplest is to say, compare GMOs to derivatives. If you just think about that for a second, even if you're not sure what either one is exactly, you realize these are very complicated technical fixes to something where the fix is maybe apparent and superficial and maybe profitable for a while, but long term it creates a big system problem. So what's broken in finance and what's broken in food are really two sides of the same coin. So part of what we do is just create space for that conversation. And, you know, we just kind of foment the conversation. And my book, Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, has been a catalyst for that conversation, which has been, of course, you know, really gratifying as the person who wrote the book. But as the person who has to be the steward of the conversation, it's pretty challenging, because it's a lot of people all around the country all wanting to, A, start talking, and then, B, start doing. So, to your point, our nonprofit is in the business of trying to help people get going in this, and then we're just connecting all the groups, and we have webinars and newsletter, and there are regional events, national events. We have ways of connecting everyone who's starting to do this so we can all learn together and hopefully enhance the how it proliferates and the outcome for everybody.
And that's slowmoney.org? Did I get that right?
Slowmoney.org. And most of the chapters have local websites, too. I mentioned a few. I would say Slow Money Maine and Slow Money North Carolina are two websites that are particularly full of interesting stuff. But if you go on the slowmoney.org site, you can connect through to any of the local. You know, we list all the locals there, too. So people, it's kind of a one place you can go to see everything.
Woody, some of my concerns and concerns that I hear from listeners in email is that the financial system is a large gambling ring that's kind of gone out of control, and you add to that the picture of national debts and municipals going bankrupt in some cases. It seems to me what you're doing, at the very least, even if somebody loses a little bit of money, we're going to end up with more of a local food supply, which is the basic supplement of life. Without that, we're not going to keep going. So is that part of your overall picture?
Of course. I mean, I love it when someone says, well, isn't what you're doing risky? And then I always say, well, risky compared to what? If you don't think it's risky having all your money in smokestacks in China, then just keep it invested exactly where it is. seems pretty risky to me. I mean, our markets are extremely volatile and unpredictable, even though right at this moment as we're speaking, there's kind of this uptick going on. But there's no surety in any of that, and there's a lot that we could talk about there. To me, I do it for a more visceral reason than all that. I mean, there's a lot of left-brain reasons you can come up with of why you should take money out of all that and put it over here. I just feel this compulsion to do something that I know in my bones is an immediate good thing. I don't need an expert to tell me that it's a good thing to invest to try to have more organic farms in my community and less toxics in the, you know, and more organic matter in the soil and more water in the aquifer and all these things. And to your point, as many, many observers going all the way back to Native Americans have said, you know, you can't eat money. So this idea that we would solve our problems through economic growth and technology by itself and not have to take care of the most basic elements of our survival, it kind of seems kind of absurd at this moment. And I think there are more and more people getting to that understanding. But as long as you have the old investing template in your head, it's really hard to take your money out of the other system because that's where our 401ks are. That's where we've been taught that that's kind of the only way to manage your money. And if all you're thinking about is arithmetic during, well, let's say any one 10-year period, maybe that's still the best thing to do. If that's all you care about is having some idea of how your arithmetic is going to work in your portfolio and you don't want to think long term, I'm not going to try to talk you out of that. But for me and the people who are doing slow money, we just have this gut feeling that we're up against something much bigger than that. By the way, I should emphasize this. I haven't taken all my money. I don't know what to do any better than anybody else. I'm trying to take as much as I can and start doing this. But we sometimes say just start with 1% of your money. Just start with something and just make a move away from the bad stuff towards this. And then just find your comfort zone. You know, how much of your money, how much of your time you want to spend doing this. But it's definitely not about throwing the entire baby out with the bathwater. I wouldn't on some theoretical basis. But it is, going back to your point, very much about believing that a few tangible steps in our community towards more resilient food, more local food is a good thing. And we have to invest in it, in a sense, no matter what the financial return to us is immediately. And it's really important to add to this, Alex, that just because you can't quantify what the other returns are doesn't mean they aren't there. This is a huge thing. We live in this culture where everyone's worshiping at the... John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard Group, the largest asset management firm in the world, has $2 trillion in assets, wrote a book called Enough, in which he said we're worshiping at the altar of numbers. If I said that, people would think I was some wacko, right? But John Bogle says that it's okay. And just because you can't immediately measure, let's say, nutrient density in food or organic matter in the soil or food miles or this or that, and you can actually measure those things, but the individual person, I'm not going to hire an expert to measure all that to tell me why I should join a CSA or why I should invest in the farm. I'm willing to take it as a matter of faith or knowledge or belief, whatever you want to call it, that that's a good thing that needs to be done. And those returns are not just financial, but they are returns to me. I feel rewarded for doing that. And I may actually get some food out of it, or my neighbors may get some food out of it, or somebody else may get some food out of it.
It sounds like something that needs to get moving a lot faster. Slow money, we could use a big growth in it.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. We're doing the best we can.
Well, some things start as seeds, and then they become waves, and they sweep away some of the old, and the new comes. We can hope. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Woody Tash. Find him at slowmoney.org. Thank you so much, Woody.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
My thanks to the listeners who chipped in to pay my gas to that Mother Earth News Fair. We ended up with a bounty of interviews with thought leaders in the underground movement to found a new and sustainable civilization. All of these things are seedlings now, I know, but they will grow into mighty things. You can support Radio EcoShock by telling your friends about us and try that Facebook connection too. Feel free to share or rebroadcast any part of this program for free. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or from our blog at ecoshock.info. I'm also asking you to support your nonprofit radio station that takes this message out on three continents. Many stations are struggling to pay their costs, even with few staff or all volunteers. You never know how many people your donation to a college or community radio station might reach. Your pledge of support can change minds and change lives. Please put your money where your ears are. You can find a list of all our stations on my website at ecoshock.org. My special thanks to those listeners who send me links and suggestions for Radio EcoShock. I can't do it without you. You're like my team. Write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Let's meet again next week.